You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, May 20th, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
How are you guys doing this week?
Quite well,
doing
sir.
Good.
How are you?
Doing good.
We have a great movie review coming up. We saw the movie Ex Machina. But Bob, you're going to start with a forgotten superhero of science.
All right, guys, for this week's Forgotten Superheroes of Science, I'm going to be talking about chemical engineer Mary Sherman Morgan, who is considered the first female rocket scientist, who also helped develop a new fuel critical to the United States' first satellite in space. Ever hear of her? Probably
not.
Morgan was born in 1921, and she died in 2004. At her funeral, one of her mom's old colleagues whispered to her surprised son, George. He said, "Your mom single-handedly saved the America space program, and nobody knows it but a handful of old men." So that, of course, came as a surprise to George, because his mom's history was pretty much a blank slate to him for three reasons. First of all, she was a woman, and if you've been paying any attention at all, important contributions from women scientists are not generally well known. And second, she also worked on top secret science projects, which has another obvious layer of secrecy on top of that. And on top of all that, Mary Morgan was fiercely private, did not like sharing anything about her past at all. When George learned some of this and he put together her obituary to the for the LA Times, they rejected it because they couldn't confirm anything he said independently. Flat out rejected it. So what he did was he wrote her biography. He found that his mom quit college to work during World War II, and after that she was hired by North American Aviation as their first woman in a technical position. And this is all without a college degree. She eventually joined a team of 900 analysts. 899 of them were guys. And so she was the only woman among them. Also at that time, if you remember, in the 50s, this is after around the time that Russia launched Sputnik, the first satellite ever in orbit around the Earth. So the United States essentially came to the company pretty much in a panic. They, like I said, the Russians had put their first satellite in orbit, and they needed help producing enough power to get their first satellite in orbit. They had done a lot of work, but one of the remaining problems was a fuel that was powerful enough. So she and a team of a few others, who I guess are really forgotten superheroes because I don't even know who they are, but her and her team succeeded even where famous rocket scientist Wernher von Braun had failed. They created a fuel combination called Hydyne, which had 12% greater thrust and higher efficiency, which is called specific impulse. And it was that fuel that was used on January 31st, 1958, when the Juno 1 rocket delivered the first American satellite called the Explorer 1 into orbit. So remember Mary Morgan. Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing, geeky rocket science stuff.
I like the fact, Bob, that she wanted to name her fuel Bagel instead of the Hydyne.
Yes.
Because you combine it with liquid oxygen, which they call Lox. This would have been Lox and Bagels. And,
yes. I loved her whimsy. And awesome. She suggested Bagel, and they smacked it down. Like, no.
They were calling Hydyne.
It Hydyne. Which Hydyne reminds me of Cyberdyne.
Cyberdyne, yeah, right?
Check this out. Her son, who wrote the story of Mary Sherman Morgan, called Rocket Girl, was published by Prometheus Books in 2013. Our friends at Prometheus.
Wow. Yes, cool. Fantastic.
Lots of good science and skeptic books come out of there.
All right, guys, let's get on with our movie review. I know you all saw the movie Ex Machina.
Yeah, baby.
Let me give you the quick summary. So, first of all, we're going to have massive spoilers in our conversation because there is no way to talk about what we need to talk about with this movie without giving away the key plot elements. So if you want to skip ahead past this topic, go to 30 minutes and 30 seconds. So quickly, this is a movie written and directed by Alex Garland. He wrote 28 Days Later, but I think this is his directorial debut. And a very very interesting, very sparse film in that very few people, and it all takes place in one essentially one location.
That's a huge point, Steve. We're talking three people in maybe four or five different rooms, and they totally carried that entire movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
minimalistic.
To me,
yes.
That is an amazing accomplishment, especially after just seeing Avengers, you know?
Yeah.
Which I really enjoyed Avengers, but that was not this. And,
relatively short movie. It's 108 minutes long.
You know, Ev, 108 minutes is an eternity if you think about standing up in front of a crowd in a room, right?
So let me give the quick summary of the plot. The movie surrounds three main characters, actually a fourth supporting character that's worth mentioning. But so Nathan is the CEO, billionaire, brilliant computer programmer, CEO of the equivalent of Google. They call it Blue Book, but it's really Google, you know, the biggest search engine in the world. One of his employees, Caleb, wins a lottery to spend a week with the CEO at his remote, you know, awesome house. And then early on, Nathan reveals that he actually chose Caleb because he has a task for him. He knows he's a brilliant coder. It's like the best guy in his company to do this. Nathan reveals to him that he created an artificially intelligent robot, android, Ava. Ava is played by Alicia Vikander, and they just CG'd, you know, like her arms and legs and her torso. So she's obviously an android, but she's got a human face, you know, skin over her face to give her a human face and human hands. So she's like this hybrid, you know, parts of her look human, parts of her look definitely robotic. The primary conflict that drives the movie is this. Nathan tells Caleb that he has 1 week to figure out if Ava is genuinely self-aware or not. So that's sort of the primary thing that drives this movie.
Yeah, or just simulating self-awareness.
Or simulating. Yeah, so one thing I really like is that, you know, Nathan says to Caleb, you know what the Turing test is, right? He's like, all right, I'm going to just state flat out, she can pass the Turing test. We're already way past that. So what I want you to do is not figure out if she could simulate a human to the degree that you can't tell the difference, because you can't. That's not the question. The question is she really self-aware or just a sophisticated simulation?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Which implies, Steve, that the Turing test, as it's kind of morphed into these days, it's not really a sufficient test to accomplish that goal.
Yeah, I don't think it ever was. I mean, the Turing test flat out cannot tell if an artificially intelligent system is truly self-aware. It's
right.
The test is it simulating human conversation well enough that that you can't tell the difference, that you can't tell it's not a person. That's why, you know, really good chatbots are starting to pass the Turing test, depending on how exactly it's being administered. So anyway, so I like the fact that that's the starting point. Now let's see.
Right.
What could we do to see if Ava is really self-aware? So Caleb, you know, has sessions with Ava where he's talking with her, and, you know, Ava is, you know, obviously human level intelligence from the interaction. But again, he's still leaving that deeper question, is she self-aware? Here's the big, big spoiler, right? So really, just if you plan on seeing the movie, you just have to skip past this part. I thought that Nathan's solution to the question was very interesting.
I loved it. I didn't see it coming. Yeah. Maybe I should have, but I loved the reveal, the big reveal at the end. I was like, oh my God, what an awesome fucking idea that was.
Yeah. So what Nathan did was Ava was trapped in a few rooms. She spent her entire existence in these like two or three rooms that are glassed off. So, you know, she could interact through the glass with other people, but she's always been alone in these rooms. Nathan brought Caleb in. He basically lied to Caleb. First, he said, you won the lottery. And it's like, nope, I actually chose you because you're smart enough to figure out if Ava is truly self-aware. Then at the reveal at the end is, now you were chosen because, you know, you have your parents are dead and you have
no girlfriend.
No girlfriend. And he was basically, you were part of the test. You weren't administering the test. What I was doing was dangling you as bait in front of Ava to see if she would realize that you are an opportunity for her to escape. And then to see if she could manipulate you into helping her escape. And that was the real test, because in order for Ava, the AI, to manipulate Caleb, she would have to show some insight into how his mind is working.
Theory of mind.
Yeah, she would have to engage in the theory of mind, which I never occurred to me as the using that as a way of testing AI. She would, you know, use sexuality to seduce him, use deception in order to get her on his, get him on her side.
Yeah.
And use manipulation, deception. And he said, she's doing all of those things, then I think she has to be functioning at a self-aware level, which is a very interesting question.
All right. So guys, here's a question. At one point in the movie, Nathan says to Caleb that when he's done, he's basically going to essentially kill or destroy, Ava. He's going to, he's going to essentially reboot her, which will wipe out enough of her memories where she will no longer be who she is now.
Essentially, formatting her.
Right. And that was a key bit of information that he told Caleb, because it gave him that final push where he would really seriously, work with her to get her to escape. But now at the very end, the plan is revealed. The test is over. The test, she passed. The test is over. So my question to you guys is, would he have let her live? Because morally, I think it's obvious that he should have. He would have let her live because she passed the test. She's alive. She's self-aware. And you automatically get a whole boatload of rights when that happens. You could also make the argument that that kind of test was unethical because if she could have been self-aware, then that's not the kind of test that any self-aware person should have to endure. But besides that, discount that, would he have killed her?
Well, that's a hard question because the Nathan character was very interesting. First of all, this is the brilliant, I think, writing and directing is you despise him from the get-go, right? I mean, he very quickly created the characters, right? You know that Nathan is a creepy jerk.
He turned me off so much. So I think he turned me off too much even because his first interaction with Caleb was, look it, I know you're in awe of me. You know, look at me. Of course you're in awe of me. Can we get past that? You know, I was like, what? You asshole.
That's such a stupid. That's the God complex.
It made me dislike him instantly.
But I think that was on purpose.
But Bob, that was the point.
Absolutely was on purpose.
I know, the whole movie,
you felt a sense of underlying discomfort throughout the entire movie. Nothing quite felt right at any point of the movie, as far as I'm concerned. And that was a big part of it.
You know, the thing is, dialogue is so important. Like that one statement, that tiny little scene, it tells you so much, and you have to appreciate, you know, why the writer put that in there, why it was in that particular moment in the film. I mean, it sets the stage for so many things.
You understand
so much about him in that one interaction. Think about what you learn. One, you learn he's an asshole. Two, you learn that he has presence of mind, that he is fully aware of that uncomfortableness. The guy is completely not intimidated about, you know, breaking that, you know, social barrier. It just gives you so much information about him. It gives you something to anchor that character somewhere in your head. And it's, oh my God, I thought that was the best scene. It was so awesome.
Yeah.
All right. So to get at your question, Bob, this is why I started talking about Nathan's character, because that's what you're asking. So you have the other big reveal in the movie is that Ava is not the first AI that Nathan created. That essentially he's been iterating this model over and over again. He runs it a simulation for a while, or he runs a test, and then he reformats it, iterates it, learns from it, then makes the next one. He said Ava is just in a chain. So it seems perfectly plausible, that he was going to take this, tweak it, improve it, and you'd get the next model, you know, the next Ava.
There's no question, guys, that he was going to delete her. No question at all.
He deleted the first eight. She was just number nine.
Yes,
I mean,
no, it's not that simple. It's because Ava was arguably the only one, the very first one that could have passed that test. And that's what I believe.
She was the only one that passed that test.
You could argue against that. You know, maybe Ava minus one, maybe the one right before Ava, essentially would pass it as well, but he still wanted to improve it, and that's possible. But it's also possible that it's not true, and she was the first one.
But what about the Kyoko character?
But I think he did reveal his true self throughout the movie.
Another spoiler there.
So
I don't disagree, though. I don't disagree with that.
He's creating artificial intelligence. He's not sure if it's really fully self-aware or not, but it certainly could be. And he essentially was torturing every model as a learning mechanism, you know, to try to iterate or improve the model. He was trapping these robots. And they even show, like, Caleb discovers the video where you see a previous model screaming, "Let me out, let me out." They get really smashing themselves to bits against the door.
That was a
screaming,
cool scene.
"Let me out." Awesome. I mean, yeah. That's pretty cruel. I mean,
I agree. Very cruel. But they weren't necessarily self-aware, which brings it into a different paradigm, I think. If there's no self-awareness, then you could argue that it's just a computer. It's like kicking your computer in many ways, not every way, but. And we don't know enough about their state of mind to make a judgment.
I don't know, Bob. It's implied. I think it's pretty implied in the film that all of those previous versions were all faulty in one way or another, but they were all conscious.
Yeah.
They weren't his final design. He's the God character in the movie. He keeps creating, and there's a flaw. He creates again and again and again. He will continue to do that. It's in perpetuity.
That brings up other, I think, subtexts in the movie. Evan, you mentioned the Kyoko character. So Kyoko was introduced as his assistant, and she is a young, attractive Asian woman who does not speak English. And he says, "Oh, that's because I want to be able to talk about work without worrying about anyone overhearing it. I want to just get into like technical proprietary details, and I don't have to worry about her understanding anything I'm talking about." But Kyoko was like almost the quintessential submissive, subservient character, right? In every way. She was his servant. He abused her. I mean, like,
oh, yeah.
Emotionally abused her, you know. And of course, this is the least surprising reveal in the movie was that Kyoko was a robot the whole time.
Yeah, and that the Caleb character didn't get that until later, I felt was a little bit of kind of a fatal flaw of Caleb.
Yeah.
He really should have known, and he should have asked, "Hey, are we alone here? By who else is here?" I don't know why you wouldn't have asked that earlier on
in
the thing, but you know, you got the movie's the movie. Yeah. What can you do?
It brings up a lot of themes. Like Nathan, I think, was a sexist and a misogynist. You know, he made these female robots and they were basically sex bots. I mean, he said that he makes a point of saying that, yes, they have a working vagina. You can have sex with these robots and they will enjoy it. I mean, and why wouldn't you design them that way? And yet the one that he made that's walking around, that's his assistant, it was his essentially sex bot and it was completely subservient, which brings up his attitudes towards women, his attitudes towards technology. And I think it was pretty clear he was also a racist.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's a coincidence that Kyoko was Asian. Did you guys ever see M. Butterfly?
Sure.
Not Madam Butterfly, but M. Butterfly.
Right.
Which was a play.
What does M stand for?
It was based on Madam Butterfly, but it reminded me of that because as a quick aside, M. Butterfly was a play based upon the older play, Madam Butterfly. And it was also based on a real story where an American officer fell in love with an Asian woman and had an affair. And it turns out that the Asian woman he was having an affair with was a guy. And the question was, how could he not have known? But in the play, it sort of flips the whole narrative of Madam Butterfly. And the main point of the play was that it was easy for him to think that an Asian man was a woman because Westerners think in their bigotry that Asians are feminine and subservient. Get it?
Yeah.
So it was easy for him to think that this Asian guy was really a
woman. Sounds like a trick question to me.
So anyway, I think I got the same vibe, I thought the same point was being made in this movie. And I think they clearly established Nathan was a sexist, a racist, master of the universe type of character.
That pisses me off. I totally agree. He was an asshole. He was a total asshole. And I wish, now that I'm thinking about it, I kind of wish they, as much as I love the movie, I wish they didn't portray him like that. Cause here's another scientist with delusions of grandeur and a God complex and all that shit.
But Bob, wasn't about that. The movie was about what it means to be human.
I know, but that was look how much time we're spending on how much an asshole Nathan was. We're putting
but
a
that's
lot
because
more
there was
on that.
A, It was so core to the movie. There's only three characters.
Right,
there's three main characters. Four.
I know, Bob.
Kyoko.
I mean, you have to have.
Don't forget the helicopter pilot.
Yeah. He was an essential protagonist, and the point is, you know, you're thinking of the impact of that character and the anti-science sentiment
of
and all
course,
that stuff.
Of
you got to just,
course I am.
You got to realize, I mean, this movie is a movie of subtext. You know, this isn't a spaceship exploding. This is a sci-fi film that actually had incredible emotional depth and complexity. You know, I thought that made him so, it made him more real in a sense,
yeah.
which was important to the movie. So just get over it. It's that storytelling, man.
So this gets to your question too, Bob. Given that subtext, he thought of Ava as a servant, a product, a machine, a model to be iterated, something that he controlled, that he owned.
Like Blue Book.
It goes in line with his whole attitude of privilege and everything. You know, I think it was very clear. The other subtext that's simultaneously running through this movie is this blurring of the lines between nature mm-hmm. and technology. What's natural and what's artificial? Is Ava a simulation or is she genuinely self-aware? She herself is a hybrid. There are parts of her that look very human and parts that are obviously robot. His house was a blending of like natural side of the mountain leading into the artificial stonework. I mean, it was beautiful, but there was this blending of the natural and the technological. And I think there was a lot of emphasis on the human body as a machine. And I think that my guess is that the point they were trying to make is that we're just machines. They're just machines. The lines are all blurred. It's all a combination. At the end of the day, there's really no difference.
Good point, Steve. About the blending also, and I'll just jump to the cinematography of the movie, which was fantastic, by the way. Each shot had this sort of blending feature to it in which part of it was light, part of it was dark, or there were these these shadows and sort of a grayscale in between. And it was this blend from lightness to darkness. And when we go back and we watch the movie again, if you'll remember that, think about that. And that sort of visually sort of, I think, captures that
yeah.
very point.
Yeah, yeah. Which is always a mark of a good movie. It's a cinematic work of art. They're telling the story cinematically with the visuals and the sets and everything.
All right, let me ask you guys a question.
Yeah.
At the end of the movie, Ava kills Nathan very, very dispassionately, right?
Technically both of them, yes.
Very slowly and dispassionately, which I found interesting. And then, you know, it's a question on whether or not she killed Caleb by locking him in the house. Was he actually locked in the house at the very end? Now, what did you guys think about that? And what does that speak about her humanity?
When I thought about that, Jay, it means that Ava's character comprised all her information from Blue Book. All the information that, you know, people put into their searches is what Ava used to figure out, you know, about people. That was her base of information. But she didn't seem to get the empathy part of being human and that the horror it is about killing somebody. That part seemed to have escaped her, that she did not pick up from her experience from other people through Blue Books.
So, I don't know. The thing is, yeah, Jay thought it was very cold of Ava to kill Nathan and that basically she was a broken model because she was able to kill. But then I put it to you, if you were trapped and you were going to be killed, wouldn't you kill somebody in order to escape and survive?
Yes.
If you had to? Sure. And you wouldn't think that if a person were in that position and the monster who was keeping them captive and going to erase them, if they killed them in order, their jailer, in order to escape, you wouldn't question their humanity or their empathy if they did that. I think that Ava was, you know, it was perfectly reasonable of her to think, all right, my only chance of surviving is I've got to, you know, escape. I obviously have to kill Nathan because otherwise he won't let me escape and he'll track me down. I have to blend in with humanity and I can only do that if Nathan is dead.
But why leave Caleb behind? She must have not felt anything for Caleb.
Well, I think
really,
it's ambiguous.
That was kind of revealing she didn't,
well, he was a threat as well, I think.
Let's explore that because it's interesting.
Well,
let
me add on top of Steve's good answer, on top of all that, even after all this happened, when she finally meets him in the hallway, Ava says to Nathan, "Are you going to let me out?" It was, to me, in my mind, she was giving him that last chance. You know, are you gonna continue to do this? Are you gonna let me out? And
sure.
He failed that test.
I totally agree.
So to me, that spoke a lot. That spoke.
She also said, how does it feel to have the thing you created hate you?
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was great. Mm-hmm. All right, guys. So at the end of the movie, now keep this in mind that Caleb set it up so when the power goes out, the doors are reversed, meaning they're all unlocked instead of locked, which is the way that Nathan wanted it. So at the very end of the movie, or very close to the end, you see Caleb sitting at Nathan's, you know, three-screened computer desk, and the power goes out again. And she wasn't in the building making it happen, which means I think that she programmed the power to go out, which let him out, which what it did was give her, like, easily weeks, if not a month of lead time to go away. Now, keep this in mind. The very end of the movie, you see her very mysteriously evaporate into that crowd, right? You know, like somebody walks by and she's gone. Of course, the director's saying, and she's gone, you know, like you'll never to be seen again. She has now absorbed, become a human and is living among us. So I think she didn't kill him. I think that she did have her morality in place.
That's very possible.
Interesting. Yep. Interesting. Yeah.
And Nathan arguably, I think was obvious Nathan needed to go. He was a monster.
Mm-hmm. What did you guys think about the tech in the movie?
It was properly
near future
placed.
Kind of,
I enjoyed it. In the very beginning, at least, she seemed in a weird way amputated because you had this clearly of human body and then underneath it you had like nothing almost. And it was really striking and effective. And I don't know if you noticed, you probably did. But the little very subtle whirrings and mechanical noises that were coming out of her when she moved, I thought was a really nice touch.
Yeah.
Like when Data, well, that's when Data, it reminded me of Data from, you know.
He never made noises though. He never made noises like that. Those were mechanical noises. No, he didn't.
I thought he did.
Well, I think they placed.
Well, maybe C-3PO then.
I think they placed it, you know, far enough into the future. They were vague enough where, you know, was it 30 years? Was it 60 years?
The technology was what it had to be for the movie to work, and who cares? That's a gimme.
Yeah.
But it seemed like it was near future, and yet the tech was probably 50 to 100 years in the future.
Yeah, I think they made a mistake that they could have easily fixed, which was Nathan is in his house alone. He would need a team of 100 scientists and engineers to help him do what he was doing, and they just didn't cover that. You have to just to say to yourself, well, he's probably got people back, you know, at the home office in a secret lab, you know, spinning up a lot of stuff.
That's not an armchair scientist kind of endeavor, so I agree with that, Jay. One thing that I really liked is her brain. At one point, very briefly, they showed her brain and how the fact that parts of the brain was meant to be static to hold memories, but also malleable to the extent that you can create new experiences and things like that. And that's kind of cool. All right, guys, here's another question. Would you see a sequel to this?
No.
No.
You wouldn't even see it.
What's the point?
Well, I'd see it, but I don't know.
I want to know what happens to
her. How could the story? It would be a whole different story.
Of course, completely different story. Completely different thing.
You could maybe do a prequel.
It'd be like 2010. You know, it's just,
didn't quite work.
You have a real like artistic film. What's the point of a sequel? You know, now the sequel is to like the superficial plot of the movie. It's like, okay, but 2010 was not really a sequel to 2001. It was just another movie in the same universe.
Yeah.
If you were going to make an AI, would you give it access to, you know, the world's databases of information and everything? Like, you know, I hope that they don't do that. I really hope they don't, Ev. I think they need to.
Wouldn't it almost be a requirement to a certain degree?
I agree, Evan. Because
I don't think it would be.
Jay, a lot of the roles we have envisioned for AIs include necessarily access to such information. If you want to have an AI help us solve the big problems of the day, they're going to need access to boatloads of information.
Right. A medical droid, it's going to have something like that.
Well, look, you know, if it's an AI though, you know, you're going to create AIs and then, you know, make them slaves. You know what I mean? Like, that's why this whole thing is so interesting to me, because if we were in that situation, right? There is a company that's creating AI android robots, you know, and her body was so gorgeous. I highly doubt we're going to get that. You know, I bet you we could develop the mind before we could develop that in a weird kind of way, but it doesn't matter. The point I'm getting at is, imagine if we did, right? You are at that point, in my opinion, creating people. So then what do? You tell that AI, hey, Ava, you know what? Right now I'm giving you access to all the medical knowledge of all humankind and you have to operate for 300 years. You have to be, you know, you have to do surgery for 300 years. It's like, you know, what if she's like, I'm not interested in that?
That we could, then we have to respect her wishes, Jay. We got to respect her wishes. When you reach that level of self-awareness, they can't be slaves. The only hope is that what you've created comes out of that process in a way that, you know, doesn't think that we're bugs. And is willing to do things for the greater good. But there's really not a hell of a lot we can do in terms of directing their destiny if they are truly self-aware.
And you'll hope they don't start stabbing people if they think everybody's going to be a threat to
exactly.
them.
Exactly.
All right. Let's try to get through a few news items, guys. So, guys, did you hear that two congressmen have proposed a federal anti-slap statute?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Oh boy.
That is fantastic news.
Yeah. Finally. Well, hopefully it'll all work out, but there's a lot of things that can go wrong. So Here's the quick skinny. A SLAPP or SLAPP is a strategic lawsuit against public participation. It essentially refers to a libel, slander, or defamation lawsuit that is frivolous, but is designed to suppress somebody's free speech by threatening them with, you know, a lawsuit that could cost tens or even hundreds of thousands of dollars. Most people don't have that kind of resources, so they will, you know, take down their blog post or podcast or whatever it is that the person issuing the lawsuit wants to suppress. Anti-slap laws are laws that make it so that you can't do that. That basically the defendant, the target of a frivolous lawsuit for libel, has a process of getting themselves out of the lawsuit without having to spend too much money. And might even be able to recover fees at the end. So one of the features is that you can effectively ask for a summary judgment prior to costly and lengthy aspects of the trial like discovery.
What does that mean, Steve?
Well, discovery, you know, is like when both sides can gather evidence, you know, and that can take a lot of time and money to do that.
And summary judgment is what?
Summary judgment is when you ask the judge, all right, even assuming these facts, which both sides agree with, the plaintiff can't possibly win. They can't, no reasonable jury would conclude that they've made their case. And so, since there's no facts in dispute and the plaintiff can't win on the facts that everyone agrees on, you can just shut the case down right now.
Yeah, there's even problems with that. I mean, you could just say, oh, there are facts in dispute and you could make it a nasty process.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's always ways to try to prolong it, you know, but this shifts the balance in the favor of the defendant. So essentially it creates, rather than the defendant having the burden of proof, essentially, in order to shut it down, the good thing about libel laws in the U.S. is that plaintiffs have the ultimate burden of proof and it's a very high burden and they have it's very unlikely for them to win this suit unless it's actual defamation, which means that the person who is engaged in the speech either was knowingly lying or had a flagrant disregard for the truth, that they lied or didn't care about the truth with malicious intent, and that it caused harm. So the plaintiff has to prove all those three things. But that doesn't really mean much at the end of the day, that burden of proof is high, because they can still force the defendant to spend $200,000 before they lose their case, you know? And that's the point. If you have money, if you have resources, legal resources, you could shut down anyone's free speech by slapping them with a suit like this. So the defendant needs the ability to extricate themselves quickly and cheaply from this suit, and also there needs to be a disincentive for bringing these kind of frivolous suits or suits designed to suppress freedom of speech by giving the defendant an automatic way to ask to have their legal fees paid by the plaintiff if it was shown that the plaintiff's case has no merit. A handful of states in the United States have effective anti-slap laws. Those are California, Washington, Oregon, Nevada, Texas, and the District of Columbia. Interestingly, Florida just passed one of their own, although it hasn't gone into effect yet, and we still need to see how that's going to work out. But now, two congressmen have proposed a federal anti-slap law, which this would apply to federal cases. And interestingly, they included a provision in there where if you are sued in state court, you can still apply to the federal anti-SLAPP statute, which means that the defendant could automatically federalize a state defamatory case.
Sure. You got to give them an option for that recourse.
You don't have to. That's actually a radical part of this law and might be the thing that kills it.
Well, no, I hope not.
Well, here's the thing. It's good if you're a defendant sued in a terrible state that has laws that that favor the plaintiff, you could bring your case to the federal level and apply and have the protection of this federal anti-SLAPP statute. That's good. The downside is
inundation.
Yeah, the federal courts can get overwhelmed with these cases.
Not unless they fast track.
Well, it remains to be seen how it's all going to sort out. If this is a sufficient disincentive to bring these suits, then that will all work out if there aren't a lot of them. But if there still are a lot of these suits, that could overwhelm the federal courts, and it could also dilute out the advantage of being in a federal court. If they're having to, you want the judge to have the leisure to like really look at the merits. You don't want them to be making decisions based upon other things, like expediency.
But if you're not a person of means, what other option would you have at that point?
Well, if you have a state,
you're going to go through the slow state process?
Well, if the state has a good anti-SLAPP law, you're good,
If they do, but we're talking about 40 something states that don't.
Yeah, I know. I agree. So I think that, this law is better than nothing. I think it's, it's flawed, perhaps, but I think that it would be a good blanket anti-SLAPP protection in the United States, and which is incredibly needed. And we still need to fight for good anti-SLAPP laws in every state.
Sure. That does not, right. You're
yeah.
Right.
We need that Absolutely. Double layer of protection, I think would be better because, if we're just being covered by one federal law and that changes or that gets watered down or whatever, then you're screwed. You know what I mean? I think having state laws covering the state cases, the federal law covering federal cases, and then, that it's a tricky legal concept whether or not, the state cases can be brought to federal court. But in any case, the bottom line is that without this major reform that we need, your free speech is completely at the mercy of anybody with money who doesn't like what you say.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a crock. That's
terrible.
That's terrible. And of course, part of the reason that we got so interested in this is because the SGU and me personally is being sued with what I consider to be a slap suit. And, it's, incredibly expensive. We have been asking our listeners for support to help us pay our legal fees, and we've been getting very generous donations. But so far, it's covered about 20% of our legal bills. And we are in six-figure territory in terms of how much we are spending to defend ourselves from this lawsuit. And the plaintiff is trying to expand the case to make it even more expensive. They're doing everything they can to compound and expand this case.
Yeah, they're trying to choke us out, basically, at this point. That's all they can do. They don't have any merit.
That's what it seems like. It's not clear whether or not our case falls under any anti-SLAPP jurisdiction. I'm not going to get into too many of the details of the case for obvious reasons, but we're trying to apply anti-SLAPP legislation to it, but it hasn't been decided yet. Let me just say that. Yeah, it's just ridiculous. Nobody should have to go through what we're going through just for exercising their free speech. And the other thing that's clear, so there have been two other cases that I want to bring up recently. This is not just about us. I mean, I really think that, first of all, this is an important issue for everybody, everyone who values their free speech. But I also think that the skeptical community in particular has a stake in this because this is what we do. Critical analysis is what we do. And to give you two recent examples, Harvard professor Peter Cohen and other researchers were just sued by a supplement manufacturer for an article they published in the scientific literature examining the efficacy and safety of a stimulant found in certain dietary supplements.
Holy crap. You can't even make a professional opinion about these things now?
I mean, it's ridiculous. It's completely obscene, but now a company is suing scientists for publishing science, which is inconvenient to their sales.
Whoa.
Think about that.
We're on a bad track here with that one. Definitely.
Now, could you just imagine the chilling effect there about how being slammed with such a massive lawsuit will shut other people up? Like, you know, now we can't speak out against, you know, and this is every company, every big major company does this, from, you know, wacky supplement companies to pharmaceutical companies to insurance companies. It's not just, you know, the pseudoscientists that do this. I'm open and happy to admit it's the laws need to change.
Yeah, absolutely. Another case I want to bring to your attention, just that because it's, I think, important to the skeptical community. Stephanie Guttormson, I think I said her name, Guttormson, is the operations director for the Richard Dawkins Foundation. She published a video critical of a faith healer, Adam Miller. Miller was presenting himself as a quote unquote medical professional, typical faith healer nonsense. And Miller's response was to sue Stephanie for the same list of, you know, this is defamatory, blah, blah, blah. Also trying to get her for using, you know, parts of his video in her YouTube video response, which is fair use, but, you know, he's trying to go after for that as well. So very disgusting, you know, just again, just trying to shut down the free exchange of ideas in the marketplace of ideas, right? The framers of our Constitution understood that having a free marketplace of ideas was vital to society. That's what the freedom of speech is all about. But it doesn't really exist until we have effective anti-slap laws. That's bottom line.
That's why it's the number one Bill of Rights. I mean, it starts there.
It's the First Amendment. That's right, along with other things. But yeah, absolutely. So this is something that we can fix. It's totally fixable. So write your congressman, write your senator, say that you support this anti-slap, federal anti-slap law. Find out if your state has a good anti-slap law. I listed the ones that do. If not, then we have a model state anti-slap statute that we could send you. We've already had a lot of people offer to pass them along to their representatives in the state. Especially if you have good connections, let us know. We're going to really try. I've contacted my representative. Essentially, we're gearing up for the next legislative season. And really make a push to get anti-slap laws passed in every state and at the federal level so that we can continue to do our job.
Yeah.
Amen. Oh, sorry.
And in the meantime, though, we're getting buried with legal costs, so we still would appreciate any support you can give us. Go to theskepticsguide.org, and you'll see our legal defense fund there. All right. Let's go on. Evan, you're going to tell us why antibacterial soap is causing cancer.
Dun, 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 the C word. Yeah, this story is hot off the presses from Yahoo News and their health section. The headline reads, "The Dirty Truth About Antibacterial Soaps." According to a new study by University of California researchers published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, the active chemical in most antibacterial soaps, triclosan, causes liver fibrosis and promotes cancerous liver tumors. In lab mice, yes. Lab mice, which were fed...
Who ate it.
Yum. Were fed steady levels of triclosan for 6 months. You gotta feed these mice large quantities of triclosan for 6 months, and then the mice will develop serious liver issues. As per the paper's abstract, here's how it reads, the end part. Findings strongly suggest there are adverse health effects in mice with long-term TSC exposure, especially on enhancing liver fibrogenesis and tumorigenesis, and the relevance of TSC liver toxicity to humans should be evaluated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the real reason we wanted to talk about this was not to scare you about your antibacterial soap, but, I mean, really, they fed mice this thing. They fed it to them for 6 months. I mean, the chance of this being relevant to, you know, people cleaning their hands is minuscule. You know, you can't extrapolate from that kind of mouse study to human toxicity, you know.
Right. I mean, the triclosan we're exposed to, we might eat little parts, you know, piece in our toothpaste, perhaps, you know, we're going to get some, you know, orally and so forth. But, you know, rub it on our skin and stuff. There are other kind of means. I mean, we're not sitting there with a plate full of it, kind of shoving it in our mouth night and day. I mean, it's really an unfair extrapolation as far as I'm concerned.
I mean, it's good. It's good to do this research, and we like to have the biggest buffer of safety possible. Absolutely. We want, you know, get exposed to a lot of things. We want risks from that to be as little as possible. But there are mouse studies showing pretty much everything causes cancer. You know what I mean? It's just, that's just not that predictive that it's going to turn out to be an actual health risk for people. There was, in fact, there was a study about a year and a half ago, where researchers cracked open a cookbook and just cataloged like the first 50 common ingredients. Then they did a literature search and found that 80% of the ingredients had published studies that show that they either increase or decrease the risk of cancer.
Right.
80%. So could you imagine tracking 80% of what you eat for its cancer effects?
Yeah, that puts a good perspective on things, Steve.
It's basically just noise in the background at this level. You know what I mean? Until it rises to a much more significant level, this preliminary animal research, especially when they're doing these extreme exposures, like feeding into them for 6 months, it just doesn't predict that there's necessarily anything there. You have to wait until this is why I think this kind of preliminary data shouldn't even really make the press.
Right.
The press shouldn't be reporting on this kind of preliminary study, because the only purpose for this is to point the way to further research, not to scare the public or to overhype, you know, on the positive end, you know, these preliminary findings. I think it's just not appropriate. But now we're going to overhype preliminary research that shows the potential for a new technology, right, Jay?
If you say so, sir.
Well said.
Right. So what Steve is talking about is optical computers. Bob, you know what this is?
Well, I sure do.
Computers that can see?
Bob and I consider this to be one of the holy grails of the next generation of computing, right? And it's so optical computing or photonic computing, it uses photons in the visible or infrared light spectrum. And these are produced by, like, you know, I'd love to see it, but super tiny little lasers or little lightsabers or whatever, diodes. instead of the, you know, electrons that are streaming through a wire, right? Electrons make up an electric current flow. And if you were to compare the speed of electrons flowing through a wire, it's about 10% the speed of light, which I thought was a very interesting fact. The University of Utah's engineers have come up with a beam splitter, right? So this can divide light waves into two discrete signals. So it takes one light wave and it turns it into two identical light waves. And I don't know if it keeps the same power behind it or whatever, but very interesting and highly important for future computing. This is one of, you know, many steps that they need to solve, but this is definitely one that they've recently kicked ass on. So it's called the silicon photonic processor. And, you know, the beam splitter needs to be incredibly small, and the team of Utah, like, virtually created the smallest one. So this is it. This is why, when you hear what I'm about to say, you're going to be really impressed. Mm-hmm. So electrical and computer engineering associate professor Rajesh Menos.
Truth or poly?
Menons. His team were able to create a much smaller beam splitter than all that came before. So the ones that were in existence before the team did what they did were about 100 by 100 microns. And Menon and his team were able to create one at 2.4 by 2.4 microns. So that is the size of almost being as small as this thing could ever get. It, by the laws of physics.
That was impressive, yep.
And to give you a better idea about how small that is, it's 1/50th the width of a human hair. So it's not even visible.
Wow. An angel can't even dance on the tip of it.
Yeah. So, you know, Steve and I were talking about this because I got really excited. And Steve's like, wait a second, you know, research it and tell me about the bad things as well. So let me give you the list of the good things about optical computing, and then we could discuss some of the bad things. So once the technology is fully realized, right, it's going to make computers incredibly fast. Now, some estimates say that photonic computing could be, you know, and I don't even know if I believe this, but this is what I'm reading, millions of times faster than our current technology.
I had the same reaction, Jay. I was like, that's awesome, but I mean, really, is it that much better?
I'll tell you why, Bob. Now, before I said that electrical wiring and electrons going through it are 10 times, you know, an order of magnitude slower. So you're like, wait a second, you know, how could it be million times faster? But I'll tell you now, and I think this explains it. So first of all, light is, of course, the fastest information can be transferred. The fastest that anything can happen is the speed of light. That's number one. Hopefully these computers will be consuming less energy, even though I read some weird conflicting information about how they might need more energy, but a lot of people are saying that they're going to be able to run on much less energy. They'll release very little heat because there's very little or no moving parts, like your SSD drive. They'll be noiseless because there'll be no need for cooling and no spinning. They'll have a higher parallelism. parallelism, to put very simply, because this is a huge thing and you should read about it, but it simply means that the computer can do more processing at the same time.
Cool.
Now, also, inside one of a processor, if you want to imagine a light-based processor, right now, processors have wiring, literal wiring throughout the whole thing, and the wiring can't touch each other, right? Because, you know, if you do, then those wires are then connected, the electrons will flow from one wire to another. Now, however, in a light-based computer, you could have light passing through other beams of light, which means, yes, in this instance, you can cross the streams. No explosions, no problems.
Nice.
This means that the processor itself can be extraordinarily compact, and it's going to be a 3D processor, you know, in a way, which is very interesting. Okay, so now here's the costly disadvantages of optical computing. Mainly, the costs are that we haven't achieved it yet, so we have to develop all of this technology, and there's lots of things that need to be developed. We don't have factories that are pumping out these processors or anything yet, right? It's literally by hand. It's like, you know, remember the first first lab-grown hamburger was like $300,000, and then like the second one was $11, right? You know, it's like one of those deals. So anyway,
you don't get ketchup with it either.
So we don't have the factories. Current software, today's software, even future software, will not be able to run on these computers. Because it's a completely different paradigm of computing. The CPU is going to work differently, and software.
Yeah, there'll be a converter.
No, there is. They'll have an emulator, but it won't be native. It'll be, you know, it won't be as good and everything. So they're saying that that's going to be a problem. Also, the components need to be exact because a light can bounce off of a molecule and go into another direction, slip down the wrong alleyway and go into it. Literally, remember before I said that the light is going to be crisscrossing itself. So the light can't touch anything. It can't be reflected onto anything or whatever. It all has to be perfect. That's huge. Any imperfections will just misdirect the light, okay? Another thing is that they say optical computers can only communicate with other optical computers because of light's electromagnetic waves. And this means you can't use an optical computer in the same network with today's computers, or they're not going to be compatible. Again, I tried to read much more about this. You know, I know quite a bit about computers. I couldn't find anything that satisfied me, but that statement kept coming up. I found that very interesting.
Jay, that being said, though, there are right now, they're working on a hybrid digital photonic computer. So they actually, I think they pretty much exist at this point, but they're hybrids. They're not full photonic. So they can coexist to some extent because there are hybrids.
Yes, that's very interesting. However, when they have the hybrid, it's a hybrid. These computers are actually converting the digital wired signals into the digital optical communication, right? We do it today with fiber optic lines. We run fiber optic lines and they go into a building, and that fiber optic signal, that light signal, is turned into an electron based signal. So yeah, they can do that. I think what we're saying is when we get to optical processors, they will not function the same way as processors do today. They won't speak the same quote unquote language.
Right, right.
All right, so when am I going to have a light-based computer?
It'll be 3.5 weeks before the first lightsaber is invented.
Okay, cool.
And that's 4 to 9 years.
And Steve, that was part of the problem I had with some of the articles I read. They mentioned that this was just one hurdle, and how many times have we heard this? It was just one hurdle that has been surpassed, but they don't tell you, you know, really, they don't put into context how many other hurdles are there really and how close we really are. So they didn't make that clear in the little research that I did on this. So that was a little bit frustrating.
Well, here's something that's available today that is damn cool. And it reminded me actually a little bit of the movie, something they talked about in the movie Ex Machina. But Bob, tell us about online time-lapse video.
Yeah, Steve, thanks for bringing this to my attention. I had briefly seen a little bit about this. I didn't really go deep at all. And I'm glad I did, because it was very, very interesting, very fun. So scientists have developed a new way to create time-lapse photography, leveraging the millions of pictures that people upload routinely to the internet. Now, these researchers are from Google and the University of Washington, and they've created this amazing algorithm or series of algorithms that automatically goes through the just the boatloads of online photos and modifies them and sequences them into these time-lapsed videos of everything from skyscrapers being built to glaciers receding away, all automatically. They call it time-lapse mining. Related to data mining, but they're calling it time-lapse mining because they're mining the pictures already online to create these time-lapse movies. Now, creating conventional time-lapse movies is essentially, in my mind, very similar to stop-motion photography, isn't it? I think that's a really good analogy. It's very time-consuming, with a high degree of patience required because you're basically just taking one frame of the film. Instead of minutely moving a puppet with conventional time-lapse, you basically have to wait for some natural or unnatural process to minutely change the scene, like a building being constructed or a glacier withering away. It just takes a long time. Any of you guys ever used time-lapse in that way on any of your cameras or smartphones?
I
wouldn't be surprised if you have, but
what happened was there was a little matchbox car and it got pushed across the room after 10 hours of filming and moved 3 inches.
That's incredible.
Impressive, Jay. I like that.
They're remaking that movie, by the way.
But mining, doing this time-lapse mining, it lets us leverage the pictures that have already been taken. They're already out there. They just need to be put together. So how do they actually do it? So what they've actually created videos from are things from the natural world, whether it's the retreat of glaciers or waterfalls changing course or the movement of sandbanks in Thailand, to the unnatural world, or, you know, buildings in Vegas being built up over time. So what they did to accomplish this, they found and used 86 million images on platforms like Flickr and Picasa and things like that. And what they did is they would run these images through an automated process of image recognition so that they could actually determine and know what's being looked at. You know, is that the Eiffel Tower? Is that a waterfall? The software knows what it is. Then it takes all those pictures and clusters them by location, by what you're looking at and by the vantage point or the popular viewpoints, like for a tourist attraction. They cluster them together by the location, and then they cluster them by the date, which is obviously pretty damn key. And that kind of information is embedded into the picture, into the metadata or whatever. They can get that information. And then the next step is to determine a master reference image. This is the main image of the thing that you are creating a time-lapse video of, and all other images will be basically or manipulated from that one vantage point. So then the algorithms would then crop the picture so that it's a similar size. They would align it. They would use techniques like geometric stabilization to make it so that it all matches up. They would color fix it so that they all match the anchor. When they went through this process, they ended up with 120,000 different groupings of these images that were all focused on one specific thing, 120,000 different things. And then they picked the ones that had more than 1,000 pictures. Some of them had 200, some had 300, some had 1,000 or more. They took the ones that only had greater than 1,000 so that you can get a good sized movie going from it. And then it was up to the computer to do all of that geometric stabilization and cropping and aligning, all that stuff. And it would take about 6 hours to process 1,000 photos. Now, of course, that's computer dependent, but also, so what? 6 hours? No big deal. Some of these pictures could have taken 10 years to be collected. So what's an extra 6 hours just to put this together? And when they were done, they ended up with 11,000 time-lapse videos that were created. And then came the manual process, because the computer isn't quite adept at saying, hey, this one's interesting and that one's interesting. That's really up to people at that point. So they had to go through a lot or all of those videos to say, all right, this one's cool. We'll put this one in the paper. That one's boring. Not much happens there. We're not going to use that one. So that was up to the people. In the future, what's going to happen? Right now, because of digital culture, this image repository online is only 5 to 10 years old, right? I mean, it's not that old, but still, there's a lot of interesting things that can happen in 5 to 10 years. And that number will always increase. Every year from now, it'll go from 6 to 11 years, you know, because you'll have more and more time, you know, 11 years, 15, 20 years. And, you know, I can't help but imagine if we had decades or centuries of these pictures to mine, imagine the interesting things that we could see. But also, the benefit of things like this is that, it's good for areas where it's not practical to have a fixed camera. And it could also be very beneficial for certain types of scientific research to see how various aspects of the earth and climate and different things change over time. So it's really cool. Something that, that we'll be seeing more of, I think, and, more people will have access to. And, check it out. Read about it. Really cool.
Yeah, the bigger, I think, thing here is that we're just putting so much information online, and people are now developing computer, you know, programs to access it in a useful way.
Absolutely.
This is just creating fun time-lapse videos, but imagine law enforcement getting their hands on this. And this is all information that's in the public domain, right? These are people who put their pictures online. You could almost like reconstruct any event anywhere, you know, just by accessing photos online. I mean, we're not at that point yet, obviously, but imagine, you know, how long is it going to be before we are at that point? Anything that occurs in the public space, you might be able to eventually reconstruct almost a video of anything that happened.
Well, Steve, I mean, what they're doing now is mainly like, you know, tourists going to the Eiffel Tower and taking pictures over the years.
Well, they're picking the low-hanging fruit, but I'm saying as more and more and more information is available, the possibilities for this kind of data mining is going to be incredible.
How about when people walk around with cameras videotaping their life every day? Well, your entire day, you've got 24 hours of high resolution, very cheap video available to you every day. Imagine being able to data mine your life. You know, say you have Jay and I have an argument over a conversation we had a month ago. It's like, bullshit, you didn't say that. I didn't mean that. Well, let's go to the videotape. You'll have the whole goddamn thing.
How cool.
Yeah, cool and scary at the same time.
Weird, yeah.
It's really going to be a different world.
Disconcerting too, yeah.
All right, brave new world. Jay, get us up to date on Who's That Noisy?
Who's That Noisy?
Who is that noisy?
Okay, last week, I played for you gentlemen this noisy.
Oh, my name is Andrew Fleek. I play the Lord Marshal of Turkey. If I should die before I break, I play the Lord Marshal of Turkey. Amen.
So, what was that, guys?
Creepy?
Yeah, creepy doll.
Epically creepy. All right, so you ever hear of a man named Thomas Edison?
Oh, yeah.
Thomas Edison. Yeah, no, he created these dolls that had little, like, phonograph-like playback devices in them. And they came to life? They were talking dolls, yeah. So he had people, you know, he recorded these sing-songy voices and stuff, but the current technology of the day made it sound uber creepy. It was crazy creepy. And the dolls did not sell well. No surprise.
I would have bought one.
Was that the uncanny valley of audio?
Yeah, but it's real human voice.
Yeah.
It's just really bad recording equipment and whatnot, and it just didn't work. It was just not good.
Plus, the voice actors, I think, didn't quite get it.
Yeah, they were trying to sound like little kids, I guess. But when you add in like that scratchiness and everything, it has like a real like ghostly, uber creepy effect. This noisy was correctly guessed first by a listener named Rich Rigolato. Sorry, Rich, if I pronounced your
Rigolato.
Last name wrong. Rigolato, from Chicago. Very good guess,
Chicago.
I guess, if you know. But yeah, it's super creepy. Very interesting. Edison is not good at making dolls.
Okay. And what do you got for this week, Jay?
This week I have something very interesting, sir. How awesome was that weird noise? Any guesses? Save them for next week.
That was very cool.
Send in your answers at WTN@theskepticsguide.org, and I will read your name if you guess it correctly. And also, I would like to thank Evan Yurkovsky for sending in this week's awesome noisy.
I didn't cough. You're
coughing and skiing. What's going on?
I heard something.
All right, well, let's go on to science fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 genuine and 1 fictitious, and I challenge my expert skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. You guys ready for this week?
Yes.
Bob, yeah, sort of. Did an excellent job last week. You got me. See if I can return the favor this week.
Don't ever do that again.
Here we go. Item number 1. Fusion researchers have found that inserting small grains of lithium into fusion plasma resulted in sustained temperature and pressures capable of producing fusion. Item number 2. A review of DNA studies finds that about half of the tree species in the Appalachians can trace their close relatives to Eastern Asia. And item number 3, a new survey finds that 18% of college freshman women endured at least one rape or attempted rape during their freshman year.
Oh, God.
All right, Jay, you seem to be enthusiastic this week, so you can go first.
This one about the fusion researchers. I mean, what are you saying here? Wow, I mean, this could be epic that they're capable of producing fusion. But isn't the real worry with fusion containing it? It's the containment aspect of it, I think, that is so vexing. But they're capable of producing fusion. Okay, they've produced fusion. Okay, I don't think that is too crazy. The second one here about this review of DNA.
It's for anyone in our audience who doesn't know, the Appalachians are in the eastern United States, like Georgia to Virginia area.
And we had people literally walking over a landmass to get to the Americas. Yeah, okay. I mean, sure, they could have brought stuff with them and... That's really cool, Steve. You know, I wonder if like all of plant life, you know, started somewhere on the planet and then just spread out and slowly evolved. You know, that makes a lot of sense too. Okay, I mean, that one has something there. And this last one about the new survey, yeah, this one is horrible. 18% of college freshmen. I mean, God, I would hate to think that. I mean, wouldn't I know? What's the statistic of how many women, you know, out of 5 women, how many, you know, had a horrible experience like this? 18%. That's a lot. Steve, can I ask questions like what country, or is this global, or, you know?
They didn't name the specific college, but they said it was a college in upstate New York.
I would like to say that this one is the fiction simply because I think that number is shockingly high. I don't know. 18% seems like if it's, oh God, I got to take that as the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Let's see. The fusion one. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's nothing's jumping out at me that this is breaking some laws of physics. This is such a complicated topic. I really am not sure. So let's look at the second one. The tree species in the Appalachians. Yeah, Jay made a good point about people migrating over the land bridge, but also I was thinking of, wind currents transporting seeds. I have no idea if the seeds of those trees are small enough. Probably not. They're probably too big to be transported by currents. So they would have had to have been brought over. Half of the trees can trace their close relatives. So if they're too big for the wind, if we go with Jay's hypothesis that they were brought over, that actually doesn't sound very feasible to me. I mean, half of the trees in the Appalachians? All right, interesting. And the 18% of college freshmen. Yeah, that seems high as well, Jay, but I mean, I'm always surprised by stats like this. It's really horrific. And I hope it's not true, but man, 1 out of 5 almost, in their freshman year. Wow, I'm kind of torn between 2 and 3 now because 18 does seem high, but I'm not seeing how those trees can trace their close relatives to Eastern Asia. Whether we ever, no, that was too far in the past. All right, screw it. I'm going to say that the trees are fiction.
And Evan.
I think the trees one is going to be the fiction. Half of the tree species in the Appalachian mountain range can trace their close relatives to Eastern Asia. Look, there's a lot of trees, a lot of species. I don't know if there's thousands. There's definitely hundreds. And half of those, I mean, that's a lot. I mean, if we were talking about maybe a set of 50 or so, then okay, then you could probably do it. But I just think there's so many. And for half of them to Eastern Asia, that is relatively small part of the whole planet, I don't see it happening. I think the trees one is fiction.
Okay, so you all agree that fusion researchers have found that inserting small grains of lithium into fusion plasma resulted in sustained temperatures and pressures capable of producing fusion. You all think that one is science, and that one is the fiction.
Ah! I almost picked that one.
Wow. Yeah.
You know,
I was considering saying, you know, I would have heard of that because that is pretty damn big. Mother.
This is based on a real news item, however.
It usually is.
So, yeah, the trick with fusion, I mean, you know that we're heavily researching how to make fusion, a sustained fusion reaction, because that could power the world with clean energy, right? This would be a total game changer. But it's hard to create the pressures and temperatures in a sustainable way in order to produce that fusion.
You only find those in stars, basically, for now.
Right. So what the researchers did find that inserting little particles of lithium into the fusion plasma does create a surprisingly large boost in the heat, but it wasn't sustainable. That was the bit. It was only for a fraction of a second, which is still a lot longer than previously. So they injected lithium while the plasma was relatively calm and the plasma remained essentially unaltered. And then they got the plasma up to a kind of turbulence that they call bursty chirping mode, because that's the sound that it makes. It makes like a chirping noise because it changes the frequency of the noise that it makes. And the lithium doubled the pressure at the outer edge of the plasma, and that this extended the length of time that the inside of the plasma could maintain high temperatures and pressure by a factor of 10. But this was still only up to about a third of a second.
All right. Yeah, I made a mistake. That's not inertial confinement. That's like a tarmac.
You're right, Bob.
With a torus.
It's a tarmac. Yeah, that's, you're right, Bob. That's the tarmac. Edge physics. It's tarmac edge physics is what we're talking about. So, so that's, it's one little baby step. Again, it's this kind of thing. It's like, oh, that's really interesting. Let me know when you're 100 steps beyond that. This may help us get one step closer to getting that sustainable temperatures and pressures that could produce ongoing fusion that we could use to generate energy. And it was a dramatic effect, but still we're up to a third of a second, which is, still really good.
Yeah. What word made me think that could potentially be science was capable.
Yeah, tell us.
Yeah, I know.
Capable is a key damn word. Yes, of course it was deliberate.
Because if I said it was producing fusion, you would have known that that was a fiction because that would have been all over the news. But yeah, the sustained was what made it false. The capable is what made it plausible. Okay. Yes. Let's go on to the second. The other two news items are interesting. Yeah. The second one's cool. The third one's horrific, as you said. But all right. So a review of DNA studies finds that about half of the tree species in the Appalachians can trace their close relatives to Eastern Asia. That one is science. This is cool. These are researchers at Duke, Durham, North Carolina.
In the Appalachians.
In the Appalachians. And they looked at the research looking at DNA analysis of the local trees. Now, the tree diversity in that in the Appalachians is a lot greater than a lot of other parts of North America. And it's not clear why, but this research helps perhaps sort this out. So the reason that there are so many similarities between half of the trees in eastern United States and eastern Asia is not because of wind, and it's not because of humans transporting it over the land bridge.
Tectonics.
It's because of Laurasia. It's when the Northern Hemisphere,
yes,
Asia and Europe were essentially joined into a supercontinent called Laurasia millions of years ago.
Oh, I thought that was too far in the past though to account for that.
So it's about, it's about 60, I know, that's what you think. It's about 65 million years ago. And there was this proliferation of trees and it was obviously a very diverse forest. Then, a lot of the forest on that supercontinent went, because of changing climate or whatever, a lot of it was destroyed by the climate. And so you had these patches of forest and desert in between. You had one patch in what is today the Appalachians, another patch in what is today Asia, and another patch in what is today Europe. And those trees are all closely related because they used to be part of one giant forest.
Wow. Awesome.
And now other species have evolved to sort of fill in, but they never achieved the same level of diversity that was preserved in these sections that can trace their diversity back 65 million years to Laurasia. Isn't that cool?
So, yeah. It's surprising that that many trees of those species survive that long? I mean, wouldn't we have artificially sort of selected those out of existence by now?
No, I guess it's, there's still enough wilderness there that the, you know, the native forests are still there.
I guess so. Yeah. Surprising.
I didn't think their history, evolutionary history went back that far. That's what made me discount it.
Well, that's why, you know, it took, I mean, the physical similarities were noticed, you know, the leaf shapes and things like that, but there was the DNA analysis that was able to reconstruct. Yeah, they're actually related, you know, that these are, closely related trees. Okay. Let's go on to number three. A new survey finds that 18% of college freshman women endured at least one rape or attempted rape in their freshman year. That is unfortunately science. This is a survey of more than 480 freshman students conducted at some upstate New York university. The actual figure is 18.6%. And yeah, that's very disturbing, but not out of line with other data. There was another recent survey which put it at 20% for just college, not just freshman year. But they reason why they targeted the freshman year is because they think that the female students might be especially vulnerable during this transition year. They're still, it may for a lot of the students, maybe the first time they're out on their own, they're experimenting with being unsupervised or maybe recreational drugs or whatever. So they suspected this would be a vulnerable time, and this survey seems to bear that out. So this, you know, there's still, I think, a little controversy surrounding what the actual numbers are. I don't think that we have sufficient data to say absolutely this is, you know, this is the rate at which this is happening. But this new survey reinforces the higher estimates of the range that people have been talking about, you know, getting close to, you know, 18.6%, getting close to 20% figure. You know, obviously these are shocking numbers. The idea that almost one in five girls are being either raped or, and this is at least once, some more than once, you know.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is, even if this is an overestimate by an order of magnitude, you know, even if it's 2%, that's way too high. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Yeah. You know, the college campuses should be a completely safe environment.
What can we do as a society to help situations like this?
I think the primary thing to focus on is the behavior. This is criminal, horrific behavior that has to stop. It has to be completely unacceptable that this sort of thing goes on. And there's a lot of specific things that need to be done, like universities need to make sure they have a policy in place and an infrastructure in place that they could deal with these. These are very difficult, sensitive issues to deal with. We've talked about this a few episodes back from the other perspective of a maybe false accusation of rape. Either way, the problem is that, you know, women who are assaulted or raped face an incredibly difficult time. You know, they undergo a trauma, and then they have to relive the trauma in order to have something done about it. They're faced with immediate skepticism, you know, perhaps out of proportion to other similar crimes, and there's all sorts of blaming the victim going on. And, you know, there is evidence which shows that it reduces their performance in college. They have problems later on. It's a really serious issue, and we need to deal with it on multiple levels. I personally think it's okay to help women protect themselves, but I don't think that it should come at the expense of them living their life. You know what I mean? They should be able to go to college, get education, and that shouldn't suffer because of the bad behavior of, it's a minority. It's a minority of men, but it's not
1%.
It's not a small enough minority. It needs to be much rarer than it is, clearly. I mean, so anyway, it's at least, you know, the last year, the attention has really focused on this. I do hope, because I always think this is very important. I do hope that there's more research using, you know, really rigorous methods. You know, we don't want the debate about how to fix this problem to get hampered in with wishy-washy statistics. You know, we want the science to be absolutely crystal clear so that we can go from there. We don't have to get caught up too much time arguing about what the actual figure is. Whatever it is, it's too high. If this survey is accurate, it's ridiculously high. But yeah, let's continue to gather statistics so that we could be really confident in the numbers. And that doesn't become an excuse to say that the problem doesn't deserve attention or is being overblown or whatever. Let's make sure we're going from a solid foundation of facts always with cases like this. But this is one more piece of data that, you know, strongly suggests this is a huge problem. All right. Sorry, I got you all with that one this week, guys.
Yeah, it's all right. It's good to talk about.
Good job. Yeah,
but there was interesting ones. The tree one, really, that was fascinating.
Yeah, that was good.
Very cool.
All right, Evan, give us a quote this week.
Here it is. I'd take the awe of understanding over the awe of ignorance any day. Well said. Who said that? Perhaps Douglas Adams?
Ah, nice.
Yes, in fact, it was Douglas Adams.
Man near and dear to our heart, given that he wrote
The
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, inspiration for the name of our show.
Absolutely, and much more than that. Oh, and did you know, by the way, we have May 25th coming up, and that is, of course, Towel Day.
Oh,
Towel Day, awesome.
And for those of you who don't know, according to Adams' most famous work, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, a towel is, after all, about the most massively useful thing an interstellar hitchhiker can have. So wave your towels on May 25th, Towel Day, celebrate Douglas Adams. He continues to influence us all.
Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Doc.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.